walked right up to the shop, poked the barrels of their guns between the logs, and fired at the heap of groaning bodies from point-blank range. When the Missourians detected no further movement inside, they entered and found a 10-year-old boy, Sardius Smith, cowering under the bellows. The youth begged for his life, but a Missourian named William Reynolds put a gun to the boy's head. Sardius's younger brother, who was shot through the hip but survived by feigning death beneath the corpses, later reported that one of the Gentiles begged Reynolds not to shoot Sardius on account of his youth, at which point Reynolds responded by explaining that Mormon children needed to be exterminated because nits will make lice. And then he dispassionately blasted the top of the boy's skull off. All told, 18 saints were slaughtered in and around the blacksmith shop. The event became known as the Hans Mill Massacre and was stamped into the Latter-day Saints' collective memory. More than 160 years later, Mormons still speak of it with indignation and undiminished rage. Joseph Smith was 16 miles away when the carnage occurred at Hans Mill, supervising the defense of Far West, which was being surrounded by 10,000 Missouri troops. He learned of the calamity the night after it happened and sank into a black depression. Over the months since the discord had escalated into increasingly bloody clashes, Joseph had waffled between aggressively fighting back and seeking a peaceful end to the conflict through compromise. After the massacre at Hans Mill, the prophet seemed to suddenly recognize that if he engaged in a full-blown war with the Gentiles, he and his followers would be annihilated. Immediately upon having this epiphany, Joseph dispatched 5 Mormons to meet with the Gentiles and beg like a dog for peace. The general of the Missouri militia informed them that there was only one way for the saints to avert imminent eradication. Without delay, they would have to deliver Joseph and 6 other Mormon leaders to face charges of treason, provide monetary compensation to the Missourians for property that had been plundered and destroyed, surrender all Mormon weapons, and then abandon the state of Missouri altogether. The conditions were unreasonably harsh, yet Joseph had no real choice but to accept them. Addressing the faithful in Far West, he put on a brave face and announced, "I shall offer myself up as a sacrifice to save your lives and save the church. Be of good cheer, my brethren. Pray earnestly to the Lord to deliver your leaders from their enemies. I bless you all in the name of Christ." The saints surrendered on November 1st. Joseph, his brother Hiram, and 5 other Mormon leaders were taken into custody by the Missourians, hastily court-martialed and found guilty of treason, a capital crime. Missouri General Alexander Doniphan was ordered, "Sir, you will take Joseph Smith and the other prisoners into the public square of Far West and shoot them at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning." But Doniphan was an uncommonly principled man, and he balked at carrying out the order. Joseph and his cohorts were American citizens, and Doniphan knew it was illegal for the military to court-martial and summarily execute civilians. Indicating that he refused to participate in such a travesty of justice, General Doniphan wrote a note to his commanding officer that read, "It is cold-blooded murder. I will not obey your order. And if you execute those men, I will hold you responsible before an earthly tribunal, so help me God." Thanks to Doniphan's brave refusal, the execution of the Mormons was called off, and Joseph's life was spared for the time being. The saints, however, were forced to accede to all the other conditions of their surrender, and once they had been disarmed, they became easy prey for Missourians bent on revenge. Their possessions were plundered, their cabins torn down and burned for firewood, their livestock shot for amusement. Mormon men were indiscriminately beaten. Rapes of women and girls were reported. And on top of everything else, they were told that they had just a few months until the spring of 1839 to leave the state. It proved to be a difficult winter for the saints. As the faithful endured famine and crippling cold, anticipating their forced departure from Missouri, Joseph remained locked up along with 9 other Mormon leaders indicted for treason and murder. The prophet, unrepentant, penned an angry screed from jail warning the murders at Hans Mill, the exterminating order of Governor Boggs, and the one-sided, rascally proceedings of the legislature have damned the state of Missouri to all eternity. As the winter wore on, the tide of public opinion began to turn in the saints' favor. Details of the Hans Mill massacre were reported in various Missouri newspapers, prompting calls for an investigation. Articles sympathetic to the Mormons were published throughout the region. The ongoing incarceration of Joseph and his brethren became a growing embarrassment to Governor Boggs, the legislature, and local officials, who were increasingly reluctant to bring the accused to trial, lest the saints win an acquittal. To save face, the sheriff responsible for guarding the jailed Mormons was encouraged by those in power to accept an $800 bribe, get drunk, and conveniently fall asleep, thereby allowing the prisoners to escape. On April 16, 1839, Joseph and his 9 cellmates slipped away into the night and fled cross-country to rejoin their fellow saints, most of whom had by then completed their exodus from Missouri and were safely across the Illinois state line. Chapter 10. Nauvoo. If our theory of revelation value were to affirm that any book, to possess it, must have been composed automatically or not by the free caprice of the writer, or that it must exhibit no scientific and historic errors and express no local or personal passions, the Bible would probably fare ill at our hands. But if, on the other hand, our theory should allow that a book may well be a revelation in spite of errors and passions and deliberate human composition, if only it be a true record of the inner experiences of great-souled persons wrestling with their fate, then the verdict would be much more favorable. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Laid out across a limestone flat beside the mud-brown flow of the Mississippi River, Nauvoo is a small, tidy town with little on its surface to distinguish it from hundreds of other small, tidy towns that freckle the American heartland. A month after breaking out of jail in Missouri, however, Joseph Smith surveyed the shore along this majestic bend in the river and resolved that the kingdom of God's capital city would be erected precisely here, in Hancock County, Illinois. A low-lying promontory on the river's east bank, the site was a patch of malarial swamp, so wet, as Joseph himself described it, that it was with the utmost difficulty that a footman could get through, and totally impossible for ox teams. But the place had a couple of mitigating attributes. It was all but uninhabited, and the owner was willing to sell acreage to the saints on credit. A deal was struck, construction commenced with characteristic Mormon industriousness, and within 5 years more than 15,000 of the Lord's elect were living in and around Nauvoo, 10 times its current population, making it the second largest municipality in Illinois. From nothing, the saints created a city that rivaled Chicago. Unlike Chicago, moreover, Nauvoo was no mere city. It was a theocratic principality, with Joseph at its head, possessing sovereign rights and powers unique not only in Illinois, but in the entire nation. These special rights were granted in a highly unusual charter passed without fanfare by the Illinois General Assembly in December 1840, a time when the state was eager to attract hard-working settlers who would contribute to the economy, and sympathy for the Mormons was running high because of their expulsion from Missouri. As an unintended consequence, Illinois set Joseph up as de facto emperor of his own autonomous city-state. He had himself officially anointed king, priest, and ruler over Israel on earth. He commanded a well-armed and rigorously disciplined militia, the Nauvoo Legion, which boasted nearly half as many men as the entire American army at the time, and then, eager for still more military power, he petitioned the U.S. Congress for authorization to establish a 100,000-man fighting force under his personal control. Congress thought better of granting this latter request, but Joseph was on a roll nevertheless, which probably came as no surprise to the prophet because he believed that his was the Lord's one true church, and he was being guided by the hand of God. Secure in this knowledge and eager to extend his influence to the whole country, in January 1844, Joseph announced his candidacy for the President of the United States. Joseph's opponents were the Whig candidate Henry Clay, Democrat James K. Polk, and James G. Birney of the Liberty Party. In an extremely close election, Polk emerged as the winner with a 48.1% plurality, defeating Clay by a scant 38,367 votes. Although historians are in unanimous agreement that Joseph had a snowball's chance in hell of winning the November election, as the Jacksonian scholar Robert Rimini phrased it, it is not clear whether Joseph himself shared this view. Already, after all, he'd accomplished much more than anyone could have imagined when he'd incorporated his peculiar new church in Palmyra 14 years earlier. Joseph took the presidential campaign quite seriously in any case, dispatching 586 of his most capable and persuasive missionaries, including 10 members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, to all 26 states and Wisconsin Territory in order to drum up support for his run at the nation's highest office. An argument can be made that Joseph ran for president because he had come to believe that it was the only way his saints were ever going to gain state protection from the terrible persecutions they had been subjected to wherever they had attempted to live. Having tried repeatedly and failed on each occasion to persuade elected officials that the government had both a moral and a legal obligation to protect the Mormons from the violent mobs that wanted to eradicate them, Joseph may have decided that his only recourse was to occupy the White House himself. Joseph venerated the U.S. Constitution as a divinely inspired document. For years he had complained that political leaders were disregarding their sworn duty to safeguard the Mormons' constitutionally guaranteed freedom to worship without being subjected to harassment, and worse, at the hands of the religious majority. Yet in both word and deed, Joseph repeatedly demonstrated that he himself had little respect for the religious views of non-Mormons, and was unlikely to respect the constitutional rights of other faiths if he somehow won the presidency and were running the show. The Mormons did not transform Nauvoo into a bustling hub of enterprise and godliness without first enduring serious setbacks. In 1839 and 1840, before the swamps were drained, epidemics of malaria and cholera swept through the settlement, killing hundreds of saints, including the prophet's own father and one of his brothers. And the Missouri hostilities continued to plague Joseph and his followers long after they had been driven from that state. Although Joseph had managed to escape from jail, criminal charges against him were still pending in Missouri. Considered a fugitive from justice, he was under constant threat of being extradited to stand trial. There was a bounty on his head. Sheriffs from Missouri came to Illinois on at least 2 occasions bearing writs for Joseph's arrest. In May 1841, a sheriff's posse managed to surprise the prophet outside of Nauvoo, arrested him, and had almost hauled him across the border into Missouri before Joseph managed to finagle his release with a writ of habeas corpus. It was a very close scrape, and the harassment provoked Joseph's ire. During a public speech soon after his 1841 arrest, he vented his anger by prophesying that retired governor of Missouri Lilburn Boggs, the saint's despised nemesis, would die by violent hands within 1 year. On the evening of May 6, 1842, Boggs was reading a newspaper in the study of his Independence home when a gunman lurking outside shot him 4 times through a window. 2 balls hit Boggs in the neck, the other 2 pierced his skull and lodged in the left lobe of his brain. Everyone assumed that he would die, and Boggs' demise was reported in newspapers across the country. Most of these papers speculated that the assassin had been a Mormon bent on fulfilling Joseph Smith's prophecy. The handgun used to shoot the ex-governor was discovered outside Boggs' study, where it had been tossed into a puddle. An investigation quickly determined that the pistol had recently been stolen from a local store. The storekeeper told the sheriff, "I thought the niggers had taken it, but that hired man of Ward's, the one who used to work with the stallion, he came in to look at it just before it turned up missing." The hired man of Ward's was an accomplished horseman from Nauvoo named Orrin Porter Rockwell. He had arrived in Independence a couple of months earlier, then quietly slipped out of town immediately after Boggs was shot. As it turned out, the reports of Boggs' death were premature. Somehow he recovered from his severe brain injuries. The papers were right about the would-be killer, though. Rockwell was almost certainly the would-be assassin, and he was a Mormon. Afraid of nothing and fiercely devoted to the prophet, Rockwell was already becoming legendary for his willingness to spill the blood of those who had wronged the church, thereby giving them an opportunity to atone for their sins, a career that would become his life's work and inspire admiring Mormons to christen him the Destroying Angel and the Mormon Samson. Although Joseph may not have ordered Rockwell to shoot Boggs, it was commonly understood by the faithful that it was a saint's sacred duty to assist in the fulfilling of prophecies when the opportunity arose. Once Boggs's death had been foretold by the prophet, nobody needed to tell Porter Rockwell what to do. Few inhabitants of Missouri, and perhaps even fewer saints up the river in Nauvoo, doubted that the attempted assassination was the work of Mormondom's destroying angel, but Rockwell had no difficulty eluding arrest. Neither he nor any other saint was ever brought to justice for the deed. Life in Nauvoo, meanwhile, continued apace. The city of the saints was booming. There on the banks of the great American River, the Mormons seemed to have at last found a secure foothold from which to spread Joseph's religion far and wide. He and his followers had come an impressively long way in the 17 years since Moroni had entrusted Joseph with the gold plates. And new converts to the Mormon Church were arriving in Nauvoo in ever greater throngs, many now coming from as far afield as England and Scandinavia. The Second Great Awakening had been crawling with impassioned, silver-tongued prophets who roamed the land, hawking upstart creeds. Almost all of these novel faiths provided reassuring answers to the mysteries of life and death, and promised converts that they would be rewarded for their devotion by spending the hereafter on Easy Street. But almost none of the new churches managed to establish an enduring body of followers. Most are now long forgotten. So why did Joseph's new religion triumph when so many of his competitors vanished with scarcely a trace? To be sure, there were numerous reasons why so many people found Mormonism so appealing. Probably none, however, was more salient than the colossal force of Joseph's personality. Charisma is a quality that's hard to define and even harder to explain, but Joseph was flush with it. The term is derived from the Greek charis, meaning graced or a special gift of God, and the Latin word charisms, defined as gift of the Holy Spirit. Its meaning has evolved through the centuries and is now seldom associated with sanctity, but Joseph's brand of charisma seems to have been true to the original definition. He was imbued with that exceedingly rare magnetism possessed by history's most celebrated religious leaders, an extraordinary spiritual power that always seems to be wrapped in both great mystery and great danger. More than a century and a half after his death, Joseph's personal incandescence has lost little of its intensity. One can still see it blazing in the eyes of his saints. In any religion, there is a tendency for the devout to reinvent their founding prophet as an idealized deity, obscuring and protecting him behind an impenetrable armor of myth. Mormons are certainly no different from the faithful of other sects in this regard, and they have done their best to airbrush every blemish from the portraits of Joseph they display to the world. But unlike Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and Buddha, Joseph was a modern prophet who lived in the brightly lit age of the affidavit and the printing press. Because many who felt the pull of his immense charm left a written record of their observations, his imperfect humanity has not been so readily erased from the historical record. The fact that he remains accessible to us as a real person, warts and all, makes it easier to feel empathy for Joseph and sympathy. It also allows fascinating insights into what makes a religious genius tick. Religious genius is a wonderfully apt characterization that originated with William James, who introduced it generically in the first of the lectures collected in Varieties of Religious Experience. It was borrowed by Harold Bloom some 90 years later in his book The American Religion as the perfect way to describe Joseph Smith. According to Fawn Brody, Joseph's biographer, the prophet had an arresting physical presence. He was big, powerful, and by ordinary standards very handsome, except for his nose, which was aquiline and prominent. His large blue eyes were fringed by fantastically long lashes, which made his gaze seem veiled and slightly mysterious. When he was speaking with intense feeling, the blood drained from his face, leaving a frightening, almost luminous pallor. He was no ordinary man. When Joseph addressed a crowd, he had a knack for making each individual feel as though he or she were being spoken to personally by the prophet. He seemed to sense each saint's spiritual needs, the entire congregation's innermost hopes and pains and hungers, and then deliver a sermon that resonated in perfect pitch with every person's private longing. Here is how Juanita Levitt Brooks, an eminent Mormon historian, described the first time a convert named John D. Lee heard the prophet preach in Missouri in 1838. Lee would become infamous in 1857 after the Saints had emigrated to Utah for his role in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Lee had come prepared to be impressed, but the reality exceeded his expectations. He thought Joseph Smith carried an air of majesty that made him seem taller than his 6 feet as he faced the audience, and more handsome and commanding than an ordinary man. Attracting every eye and holding every heart by the sheer magnetism of his personality, he played upon the congregation as though it were a musical instrument responsive to his slightest touch. Fawn Brody was struck by accounts of Joseph's magnificent self-assurance. Increased success had served to intensify his boldness and exuberance. The zest for living that he radiated never failed to inspire his own people with a sense of the richness of life. They followed him slavishly and devotedly, if only to warm themselves in the glow of his presence. They built for him, preached for him, and made unbelievable sacrifices to carry out his orders, not only because they were convinced that he was God's prophet, but also because they loved him as a man. They were as elated when he won a wrestling match as they were awed when he dictated a new revelation. They retold tales of his generosity and tenderness, marveling that he fed so many of the poor in Nauvoo at his table without stint, and that he entertained friend and enemy alike. He was a genial host, warm-hearted and friendly to all comers, and fiercely loyal to his friends. Arguing that the popularity of the Mormon Church was primarily a function of Joseph's singular charisma, Brody insists that the Book of Mormon lives today because of the prophet, not he because of the book. Perhaps. But the allure of the new theology he introduced should not be discounted. Joseph's inspired reworking of the traditional Christian narrative had much to do with his religion's rapid growth. To believers, of course, Mormon doctrine is the incontrovertible word of God. That word was nevertheless delivered via a very human instrument, Joseph Smith, who possessed uncanny theological instincts. Mormonism appeared in the right place at the right time to exploit a ripe niche that had opened in the nation's ever-shifting spiritual ecology. Many Americans were dissatisfied with the calcified religions of the old world. Joseph preached a fresh message that was exactly what a great number of people were eager to hear. He took measure of the public's collective yearning and intuitively shaped his ideas to fit the precise dimensions of that inchoate desire. Joseph had convincing answers to the thorniest existential questions, answers that were both explicit and comforting. He offered a crystal clear notion of right and wrong, an unambiguous definition of good and evil. And although his perspective was absolutist and unyielding, it presented a kinder, gentler alternative to Calvinism, which had been the ecclesiastical status quo in the early years of the American Republic. Calvinists taught that mankind was by nature evil and was watched over by a wrathful God bent on making humans atone for Adam's original sin. They warned that the fires of hell were real. Suffering, they preached, was good for you. In Joseph's more optimistic cosmology, God's chosen people, the Mormons, were inherently virtuous, albeit surrounded by wickedness, and didn't need to atone for anything. Making money was a righteous pursuit. The Lord smiled on the rich as well as those who aspired to become rich. And anyone who elected to obey church authorities, receive the testimony of Jesus, and follow a few simple rules could work his way up the ladder until, in the afterlife, he became a full-fledged God, the ruler of his very own world. Joseph was no hair-shirt prophet, Fawn Brody observed. He believed in the good life, with a moderate self-indulgence in food and drink, occasional sport, and good entertainment. And that he succeeded in enjoying himself to the hilt detracted not at all from the semi-deification with which his own people enshrouded him. Any protests of impropriety dissolved before his personal charm. "Man is that he might have joy" had been one of his first significant pronouncements in the Book of Mormon, and from that belief he had never deviated. He was gregarious, expansive, and genuinely fond of people. and it is no accident that his theology in the end discarded all traces of Calvinism and became an ingenious blend of supernaturalism and materialism, which promised in heaven a continuation of all earthly pleasures, work, wealth, sex, and power. Joseph's budding religion was both a reflection of the era's Jacksonian ideals and a reactionary retreat from them. On the one hand, Joseph was a champion of the common man and a thorn in the side of the ruling elite. But on the other, he was deeply suspicious of the confusing babble of ideas sweeping the country and was made nervous by the fickleness of democratic governance. His church was an attempt to erect a wall against modernity's abundance of freedom, its unbridled celebration of the individual, Mormonism's strictures and soothing assurances, its veneration of order, beckoned as a refuge from the complexity and manifold uncertainties of 19th century America. Joseph's fresh take on Christianity excited his followers. Converts were energized by his groundbreaking doctrines, and the innovations didn't stop. Mormons could watch their church taking form before their very eyes in all sorts of novel and fantastic ways. By the mid-1840s, when Nauvoo was in full flower, Joseph had received 133 divine commandments that were weighty enough to be recorded for eternity in the Doctrine and Covenants, reflecting a significant evolution in Mormon theology. In several important regards, the religion practiced in Nauvoo was quite different from the religion practiced in Palmyra when the church was initially incorporated. And none of these changes had greater repercussions than the commandment Joseph recorded on July 12, 1843, canonized in D&C as Section 132, which very nearly shattered the church, brought about Joseph's death at the hands of a lynch mob, and has been reverberating through American society ever since. It was in D&C 132 that God revealed the new and everlasting covenant of plural marriage, a custom more commonly known to non-Mormons as polygamy. Chapter 11. The Principle. It was in Kirtland that Joseph began to tamper delicately with one of the most basic mores in Occidental society. He looked upon that society with singular detachment that can come only to a man satisfied with his own ultimate authority and possessed by a longing to remold the world closer to his heart's desire. Nothing was so sacred that it could not be recast into a new utility or a new beauty. Monogamy seemed to him, as it has seemed to many men who have not ceased to love their wives, but who have grown weary of connubial exclusiveness, an intolerably circumscribed way of life. "Whenever I see a pretty woman," he once said to a friend, "I have to pray for grace." But Joseph was no careless libertine who could be content with clandestine mistresses. There was too much of the Puritan in him, and he could not rest until he had redefined the nature of sin and erected a stupendous theological edifice to support his new theories on marriage. Fawn Brody, "No Man Knows My History." In the early 1980s, when Dan Lafferty came across a copy of The Peacemaker in the library of Brigham Young University, he quickly became convinced that it had been written by Joseph Smith using the pen name of Udney Hay Jacob. The booklet had been printed in Nauvoo in 1842 by the Prophet's own press. But Dan Lafferty is probably wrong about its authorship. Udney Hay Jacob was no apparition. His was not a nom de plume. He actually existed, and most scholars believe that Jacob, not Joseph Smith, wrote The Peacemaker. But most of those same scholars also acknowledge that the treatise would never have been published by the church printing office with Joseph's name on the title page had the prophet not wholly endorsed it. If he wasn't the author of The Peacemaker, Joseph was almost certainly responsible for the booklet's conception and publication. Joseph had been considering polygamy and its place in the cosmological order at least since the church was founded, but he was reluctant to broach this delicate subject with his saints lest they recoil in shock. By the time the Mormons were established in Nauvoo, he thought they might finally be ready to receive the principle, and he seems to have published The Peacemaker as a trial balloon. According to John D. Lee, who was living in Nauvoo when the booklet appeared, Joseph, the prophet, set a man by the name Sidney Hay Jacobs to select from the Old Bible such scriptures as pertain to polygamy, or celestial marriage, and to write it in pamphlet form and to advocate that doctrine. This he did as a feeler among the people to pave the way for celestial marriage. Celestial marriage, spiritual wifery, and plural marriage are among the terms Joseph Smith coined as euphemisms for polygamy. Unfortunately, the feeler did not produce the desired response. The peacemaker created an uproar, prompting Joseph to claim, disingenuously, that it had been published without my knowledge, adding, "Had I been apprised of it, I should not have printed it." The outcry over the booklet forced the prophet to issue strong public denunciations of polygamy, which was awkward because he had, in fact, been secretly engaging in spiritual wifery at least since 1833, and there is compelling circumstantial evidence that he began the practice even earlier. One of the first women rumored to have been intimate with Joseph outside his marriage to Emma was Marinda Nancy Johnson, whom he met in 1831, shortly after the Saints moved from Palmyra to Kirtland, Ohio. Marinda's mother, who suffered from chronic rheumatism that had paralyzed one of her arms, was among the crowds of curious Ohioans who came to see the Mormon prophet with their own eyes. Accompanying the ailing woman was her husband, Benjamin, and a skeptical Methodist preacher who demanded of Joseph, "Here is Mrs. Johnson with a lame arm. Has God given any power to men now on earth to cure her?" Taking hold of Mrs. Johnson's incapacitated hand, Joseph declared, "Woman, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, I command thee to be whole." According to a credible witness, Mrs. Johnson at once lifted her arm up with ease. Both Mr. and Mrs. Johnson were so moved by this miracle that they converted on the spot to Mormonism and invited the prophet to meet their 15 children, including 15-year-old Marinda. When she learned that her parents had come under the sway of Joseph Smith, Marinda later told a journalist, she initially felt indignation and shame that they had been duped by such a ridiculous fake. But that was before she met Joseph herself and was exposed to the direct radiance of his charm. Later, upon encountering him for the first time, she reported, "The prophet looked her full in the eye. With the greatest feeling of shame ever experienced, she felt her very soul laid bare before this man as she realized her thoughts concerning him. He smiled, and her anger melted as snow before the sunshine. She knew he was what he claimed to be, and never doubted him thereafter." In the summer of 1831, the Johnson family took Joseph and Emma Smith into their home as boarders, and soon thereafter the prophet purportedly bedded young Marinda. Unfortunate, the liaison apparently did not go unnoticed, and a gang of indignant Ohioans, including a number of Mormons, resolved to castrate Joseph so that he would be disinclined to commit such acts of depravity in the future. According to Luke Johnson, Marinda's older brother, on March 24, 1832, a mob of 40 or 50 came to the Johnson house, forced their way into Joseph's room in the middle of the night, and Carnot Mason dragged Joseph out of bed by the hair of the head. He was then seized by as many as could get hold of him and taken about 40 rods from the house, stretched on a board, and tantalized in the most insulting and brutal manner. They tore off the night clothes that he had on for the purpose of emasculating him, and had Dr. Dennison there to perform the operation. But when the doctor saw the prophet stripped and stretched on the plank, his heart failed him, and he refused to operate. Having lost the nerve to follow through with their castration plans, the mob severely beat Joseph, covered his naked body with tar, plastered him with feathers from a down pillow, and then abandoned him in the woods. Despite this harrowingly close call, Joseph remained perpetually and hopelessly smitten by the comeliest female members of his flock. Among them was a nubile resident of Kirtland named Fanny Alger, who was introduced to Joseph in 1830, after her parents became some of the earliest converts to the church. By the winter of 1833, when Fanny was 16, she had moved into the Smith household as a domestic servant and had grown very close to both Smiths, particularly Emma. According to a Mormon named Anne Eliza Webb Young, Fanny was a very pretty, pleasing young girl, and Mrs. Smith was extremely fond of her. No own mother could be more devoted, and their affection for each other was a constant object of remark, so absorbing and genuine did it seem. Joseph, however, was also extremely fond of young Fanny, and he took her as his plural wife in February or March 1833. She may well have been the second woman after Emma whom he formally married. He tried to keep the relationship secret, but Emma eventually discovered Joseph and Fanny flagrante delicto, and by the fall of 1835 had thrown the girl out of their house. Neither Emma's tears nor her rage were enough to make Joseph monogamous, however, nor were the prevailing mores of the day. He kept falling rapturously in love with women, not his wife. And because that rapture was so wholly consuming and felt so good, it struck him as impossible that God might possibly frown on such a thing. Joseph wasn't by nature reflective or deliberative. He conducted his life impulsively, acting according to instinct and emotion. The Lord, it seemed to him, must surely have intended man to know the love of more than one wife, or he wouldn't have made the prospect so enticing. In the Old Testament, moreover, Joseph found ample proof that this was indeed God's intent, wherein the polygamous customs of Abraham and Jacob, the patriarchs from whom the Mormons were directly descended, were recounted without reproach or shame. Joseph continued to take plural wives throughout the 1830s in Ohio and Missouri, and he married with even greater frequency in Nauvoo in the early 1840s, but he did whatever was necessary, including bald-faced lying, to conceal his polygamous behavior, not only from censorious non-Mormons, but from all but a select few of his own followers as well. As the prophet explained to his innermost circle in 1832, he had inquired of the Lord concerning the principle of plurality of wives, and he received for answer that the principle of taking more wives than one is a true principle, but the time had not yet come for it to be practiced. More correctly, the time had not yet come for the practice to be made public. So Joseph kept the fact of his multiple wives a secret and bided his time until the proper moment for revealing the sacred principle arrived. He did not have similar qualms about revealing other divine commandments, however. In Nauvoo, the prophet entered a phase of feverish doctrinal creativity, resulting in the church's most innovative theological developments. During this period, for instance, Joseph revealed the principle of vicarious baptism for the dead, whereby living saints could be baptized in proxy for deceased ancestors, giving departed generations an opportunity to experience salvation through the one true church, even if the departed had passed away long before Joseph introduced Mormonism to the world. It was also in Nauvoo that he introduced the elaborate rituals of the temple endowment ceremony and revealed not only that God had once been a man, but even more astonishing, that every man has the capacity to become a god. And then on July 12, 1843, he formally codified the divine commandment revealing the sacred importance of plural marriage. Unlike the other revelations of this period, it was kept secret and wasn't acknowledged until 1852, a full 8 years after the prophet's death. This burst of theological inspiration coincided with an extended eruption of libidinous energy. Between 1840 and 1844, God instructed the prophet to marry some 40 women. Most were shocked and revolted when Joseph revealed what the Lord had in mind for them. Several were still pubescent girls, such as 14-year-old Helen Marr Kimball. Although she acquiesced when the prophet explained that God had commanded her to become his plural wife and that she would be permitted 24 hours to comply, Helen later confided to a friend, "I was young and they deceived me by saying the salvation of our whole family depended on it." Joseph married Helen Marr Kimball in Nauvoo in May 1843. Earlier that same month, young Lucy Walker was also wed to the prophet after being similarly coerced. Her father had been among those shot during the Hans Mill massacre, although he was one of the lucky few who managed to survive the carnage inside the blacksmith shop. In January 1842, Lucy's mother died of malaria, a plague that was rife in Nauvoo's swamps. Joseph responded to this tragedy by sending Lucy's grief-stricken father on a 2-year mission to the eastern states to heal his broken heart. In their father's absence, the prophet then adopted Lucy and most of her siblings. According to Lucy's autobiography, while she was living in the prophet's home, "President Joseph Smith sought an interview with me and said, 'I have a message for you. I have been commanded of God to take another wife, and you are the woman.' My astonishment knew no bounds. When the horrified girl balked at his proposal, Joseph explained to Lucy that if she refused, she would face eternal damnation. "I have no flattering words to offer," he said. "It is a command of God to you. I will give you until tomorrow to decide this matter. If you reject this message, the gate will be closed forever against you." Lucy reacted with both anger and despair. This aroused every drop of scotch in my veins. For a few moments I stood fearless before him and looked him in the eye. I felt at this moment that I was called to place myself upon the altar, a living sacrifice. This was too much. The thought was unbearable. Courageously she replied to the prophet that unless she personally received a revelation straight from God, that he wanted her to wed the prophet, she wouldn't do it. At which point, she wrote, Joseph stood before her with the most beautiful expression of countenance and said, "God Almighty bless you. You shall have a manifestation of the will of God concerning you, a testimony that you can never deny." According to Lucy's memoirs, it was near dawn after another sleepless night when my room was lighted up by a heavenly influence. To me, it was, in comparison, like the brilliant sun bursting through the darkest cloud. My soul was filled with a calm, sweet peace that I never knew. Supreme happiness took possession of me, and I received a powerful and irresistible testimony of the truth of plural marriage, which has been like an anchor to the soul through all the trials of life. I felt that I must go out into the morning air and gave vent to the joy and gratitude that filled my soul. As I descended the stairs, President Smith opened the door below, took me by the hand, and said, "Thank God you have the testimony. I too have prayed." He led me to a chair, placed his hands upon my head, and blessed me with every blessing my heart could possibly desire. Lucy Walker was married to the prophet on May 1, 1843, a day after turning 17. It beggars the imagination to consider how Joseph managed to maintain relationships with 40 spouses. Not even this profusion of wives, however, managed to sate his appetite. According to Sarah Pratt, the wife of Mormon apostle Orson Pratt, the prophet Joseph used to frequent houses of ill fame. Mrs. White, a very pretty and attractive woman, once confessed to me that she made a business of it to be hospitable to the captains of the Mississippi steamboats. She told me that Joseph had made her acquaintance very soon after his arrival in Nauvoo, and that he had visited her dozens of times. Nauvoo was a closely woven, self-absorbed community that generated a robust flow of gossip. Try as he might, it was impossible for Joseph to conceal so much illicit activity from his followers. Time and again, public allegations would be made against the prophet, but he was extremely adept at portraying his accusers as instruments of Satan out to defame not only him, a persecuted innocent, but all of Mormondom. Joseph repeatedly managed to sweep unsavory charges under the rug before irreparable damage could be inflicted, a talent he shared, of course, with many successful religious and political leaders through the ages. Throughout this period of frenzied coupling, Joseph adamantly denied that he endorsed plural marriage, let alone engaged in the practice himself. "When the facts are proved, truth and innocence will prevail at last," he asserted in a speech given to the citizens of Nauvoo in May 1844. What a thing it is for a man to be accused of committing adultery and having 7 wives when I can find only one. I am the same man and as innocent as I was 14 years ago, and I can prove them all perjurers. His denials had always gotten him off the hook before, but his repeated success at wiggling out of tight situations incubated a dangerous hubris, which in turn increased his sexual recklessness, and it all caught up to him shortly after he delivered the speech quoted above. In the spring of 1844, a scandal of Monica Lewinsky-like proportions exploded in Nauvoo, and this time, finally, the conflagration was too big and too hot to be extinguished by the prophet's charm. Chapter 12. Carthage. When Smith led his followers into Nauvoo, one may argue that Smith had done all he needed to do. His followers had memories of persecution to nurture. They had created distinct forms of worship organized around an unusual concept of priesthood and had gathered a community. Smith entered Nauvoo with a political welcome and a generous city charter that allowed Mormons a considerable amount of autonomy. Yet precisely at that point, he embarked on a course of new departures, introduced in politically maladroit ways that threatened to destroy everything he had created. R. Lawrence Moore, Religious Outsiders and the Making of Americans. Despite Joseph Smith's many forceful denials, by 1844, several members of the Prophet's inner circle had been told the truth about his spiritual wifery, and some had been shown the secret revelation of July 12, 1843, concerning the doctrine of celestial marriage. A few were even practicing polygamy themselves, but not everyone who had been let in on the secret approved of the doctrine. Foremost among those who objected was his original wife, Emma Smith. She had been married to Joseph since 1827, still loved him, and at the age of 39 had no desire to share her husband with dewy juveniles less than half her age. Joseph had promised to be faithful to Emma when he'd made his wedding vows, and she expected him to keep that promise. Outspoken by nature, Emma despised polygamy and did not hesitate to make her views known to the Prophet. At one point, she even threatened to take a plural husband if he didn't give up his plural wives, prompting Joseph on June 23, 1843, to complain to his secretary that Emma was disposed to be revenged on him for some things. She thought that if he would indulge himself, she would too. Emma harangued Joseph so relentlessly about his philandering that the original intent of the revelation canonized as Section 132 seems to have been simply to persuade Emma to shut up and accept his plural wives, while at the same time compelling her to refrain from indulging in any extracurricular sex herself. Indeed, on the morning of July 12th, just before Joseph recorded the notorious revelation for posterity, his brother Hiram explicitly urged the Prophet, "If you will write the revelation on celestial marriage, I will take and read it to Emma, and I believe I can convince her of its truth, and you will hereafter have peace." A very dubious Joseph replied, "You do not know Emma as well as I do." But Hiram persisted. "The doctrine is so plain I can convince any reasonable man or woman of its truth, purity, or heavenly origin." Thus persuaded, Joseph agreed to commit to paper the revelation that became Section 132. Not coincidentally, it repeatedly mentions Emma by name. For example, in the revelation's 54th verse, God warns, "And I command mine handmaid Emma Smith to abide and cleave unto my servant Joseph, and to none else. But if she will not abide this commandment, she shall be destroyed, saith the Lord. For I am the Lord thy God, and will destroy her if she abide not in my law." The meat of the matter, the part of the commandment that gives men license to marry a plurality of wives, occurs just before the conclusion of the revelation, when the Lord tells Joseph, "If any man espouse a virgin and desire to espouse another, then he is justified. He cannot commit adultery, for they are given unto him. And if he have 10 virgins given unto him by this law, he cannot commit adultery, for they belong to him, and they are given unto him. Therefore he is justified. But if one or either of the 10 virgins, after she is espoused, shall be with another man, she has committed adultery, and shall be destroyed. For they are given unto him to multiply and replenish the earth, according to my commandment." After Joseph had finished dictating the revelation to his secretary, Hiram delivered the 10-page document to Emma. William Clayton, Joseph's loyal personal secretary, declared in a letter 28 years later, "I did write the revelation on celestial marriage given through the Prophet Joseph Smith on the 12th day of July, 1843. When the revelation was written, there was no one present except the Prophet Joseph, his brother Hiram, and myself. It was written in the small office upstairs in the rear of the brick store which stood on the banks of the Mississippi River. It took some 3 hours to write it. Joseph dictated sentence by sentence, and I wrote it as he dictated. After the whole was written, Joseph requested me to read it slowly and carefully, which I did, and he then pronounced it correct. Unfortunately for Joseph, it did not have the desired effect. When Emma read it, she became apoplectic. Hiram reported that he had never received a more severe talking to in his life, and that Emma was very bitter and full of resentment and anger. She proclaimed that she did not believe a word of the revelation and remained steadfast in her refusal to accept Joseph's marriages to other women, which didn't deter the prophet from taking more wives, but he made no further effort to win Emma's consent. Emma sought solace from her friend William Law, who, although also a close friend of Joseph's, was sympathetic to Emma's plight. A longtime member of the church, Law possessed incorruptible integrity and had served as the prophet's trusted second counselor for more than 2 years. In January 1844, Law encountered Joseph on the streets of Nauvoo and begged him to renounce the detestable polygamy revelation. According to Law's son Richard, his father put his arms around the neck of the prophet and was pleading with him to withdraw the doctrine of plural marriage, with tears streaming from his eyes. The prophet was also in tears, but he informed Law that he could not withdraw the doctrine, for God had commanded him to teach it, and condemnation would come upon him if he was not obedient to the commandment. Law's abhorrence of polygamy, to say nothing of the emotional support he provided Emma, severely strained his relationship with Joseph. Their friendship was finally severed altogether when Joseph endeavored to seduce Law's wife, Jane, by making the most indecent and wicked proposals to her. Incensed and disgusted, in April 1844, William Law demanded that the prophet publicly acknowledge his wicked behavior and cease from his abominations. Joseph responded by having Law excommunicated. Law's reaction to this insult was to declare that Joseph was a fallen prophet, and then, on May 12th, to establish an institution he called the Reformed Mormon Church, which did not sanction polygamy. According to Fawn Brody, Law had courage, tenacity, and a strange, misguided idealism. Although he was surrounded chiefly by men who believed Joseph to be a base impostor, he clung to the hope that he could effect a reformation in the church. To this end, he set up a church of his own with himself as president, following faithfully the organization of the main body. This in itself would not have been serious, for Joseph had seen rival prophets spring out of the grass at his feet before, and they had come to naught. Usually they tried to imitate him, giving out revelations that sounded stale and flat beside his own. But Law was cut to a different pattern. Actually, he was on the road to complete and ugly disillusionment, but he was walking backward away from the church, looking eagerly for something in the landscape to which he could cling, grasping at every tree and hedgerow. His desperate desire to reform the church made him far more formidable than if he had set out to damn the prophet and all his works. Law was also made formidable by dint of being rich, which allowed him to buy his own printing press. On June 7, 1844, the first and only edition of a newspaper called the Nauvoo Expositor emerged from the new press. Law printed 1,000 copies. The lead editorial exclaimed, "We are earnestly seeking to explode the vicious principle of Joseph Smith and those who practice the same abominations and whoredoms." The four-page broadsheet railed against Joseph's disdain for the separation of church and state, his usurpation of political power, and his shady financial dealings. But the paper's primary objective was to expose the secret doctrine of polygamy. The editors promised that in the coming days, several affidavits will be published to substantiate the facts alleged. Most of Nauvoo's residents reacted to the publication with anger, directed not at Joseph, to whom they remained devoted, but at the paper and its owners. The prophet was nevertheless worried that the expositor put his control of the church in dire peril, so he called an emergency meeting of the Nauvoo City Council, warning that the paper threatened to destroy the peace of the city and was a public nuisance. Joseph, acting in his capacity as mayor, ordered the city marshal to destroy the printing press from whence issues the Nauvoo Expositor, and burn all the expositors and libelous handbills found in said establishment. On the evening of June 10th, more than 200 armed members of the Nauvoo Legion, led by Hiram Smith and Apostle John Taylor, under orders from the Legion's commander, Lieutenant General Joseph Smith, broke down the front door of the expositor offices with a sledgehammer, smashed the press, scattered the type, and then burned the wreckage to ashes, while the multitude made the air ring with their hideous yells. The publishers of the expositor sought redress from the local courts, charging the prophet and his henchmen with a variety of crimes. The problem was, Joseph controlled the courts along with every other branch of government in Nauvoo. To nobody's surprise, all those involved in the destruction of the press were completely exonerated, including the prophet. William Law, fearing for his life, had by this time fled Nauvoo. His reformed Mormon church withered and ultimately disappeared. Joseph, it seemed, had prevailed yet again over his adversaries. He'd badly miscalculated how non-Mormons in Hancock County would react to these shenanigans, however. Relatively few people outside of Nauvoo knew much at that point about Joseph's doctrine of polygamy, but bad blood between the saints and the Gentiles who lived around them had been building for at least 2 years. Although Joseph and his followers had been welcomed by the citizens of Illinois when they'd first arrived, the same attitude of divine entitlement that had turned Missourians against the Mormons gradually antagonized the residents of Hancock County as well. The county was named after John Hancock, the first person to sign the Declaration of Independence, a committed populist with pronounced contempt for those in positions of authority who abused their power. In the spirit of their county's namesake, non-Mormons were especially alarmed by Joseph's penchant for theocratic governance, as well as his apparent disregard for every article of the United States Constitution, except those that assured Mormons the freedom to worship as they saw fit. Joseph often asserted his belief in the ideal of democracy and in the essential value of the protections codified in the Constitution. But he also believed that democracy and constitutional restraint were rendered moot in his own case, because he had been singled out by the Lord to be his messenger. God spoke through him. Upon Joseph's divine installation as ruler of the world, there would be no further need for democracy, because God, for all intents and purposes, would be in charge. Surely Joseph believed the American people would understand this once they were given an opportunity to hear his message, the righteousness and undeniable truth of the Mormon faith. But Joseph's avowed intent to replace the elected government of the United States with a government of God was poorly received by the Gentile residents of Hancock County, who didn't fancy becoming subjects of King Joseph Smith. Joseph's non-Mormon neighbors were distressed by the way the saints voted as a uniform block in lockstep with the prophet's instructions, using that leverage to exert inordinate influence in the state government. Freedom of the press, moreover, was taken no less seriously in Hancock County than in the rest of Jacksonian America. When Joseph ordered the destruction of the Nauvoo expositor, it confirmed a growing fear among non-Mormons that he was a megalomaniacal tyrant who posed a clear and present danger to the peace and stability of the region. The obliteration of the expositor had the county's Gentile residents literally up in arms. An editorial published in the nearby town of Warsaw howled, "War and extermination is inevitable. Citizens arise, one and all. Can you stand by and suffer such infernal devils to rob men of their property rights without avenging them? We have no time for comment. Every man will make his own. Let it be with powder and ball." The air over Hancock County crackled with hostility. Anticipating imminent retaliation from the Gentiles, on June 18th, Joseph declared martial law and mobilized his Mormon army, the 5,000-man Nauvoo Legion. Fearing the outbreak of civil war, Illinois' governor, Thomas Ford, a fair-minded leader who was not unsympathetic to the Mormons, responded by demanding that Joseph and Hiram Smith, John Taylor, and others responsible for destroying the press surrender to face charges in Carthage, the Hancock County seat. Governor Ford promised that if the prophet turned himself in, he would personally guarantee Joseph's safety. But, Ford cautioned, "If you, by refusing to submit, make it necessary to call out the militia, I have great fears that your city will be destroyed and your people, many of them, exterminated. You know the excitement of the public mind. Do not tempt it too far." Joseph replied to Ford, saying he worried that if he and his cohorts were to turn themselves over to non-Mormon authorities, they would be taken from place to place, from court to court, across creeks and prairies till some bloodthirsty villain could find his opportunity to shoot us. Instead of surrendering in the middle of the night on June 23rd, Joseph and his brother Hiram were rowed across the Mississippi by their fearsome bodyguard, Porter Rockwell, where they fled into the wilds of Iowa, intending to make a break for the Rocky Mountains. A day later, though, while Joseph and Hiram waited for the delivery of horses to carry them west, Joseph received an impassioned letter from Emma urging him to return to Nauvoo. The messenger who delivered the letter told the prophet that many of the saints believed he had abandoned them out of cowardice,